Welcome back to the Angletopia podcast, where we explore British history, travel, and culture. I'm your host, Jonathan Thomas, and today I'm thrilled to welcome back photographer and adventurer Quentin Lake. Last year, we spoke about his extraordinary five-year, 11,000-kilometer journey around the entire coastline of Britain, documented in his stunning book, The Perimeter, which I highly recommend everybody pick up because the book is beautiful and it's available in the U.S. now. Quentin has also walked all 16 of Britain's national trails. And today we're going to focus on one that's particularly close to my heart, the Hadrian's Wall National Trail, because I'm going to be walking it in August. The Hadrian's Wall Pass stretches 84 miles across northern England from Wall's End near Newcastle in the east to Bowness on Solway and Cumbria on the west coast of England. It follows the line of the UNESCO heritage site built by Roman Emperor Hadrian in AD 122, one of the most impressive Roman monuments anywhere in the world still standing. This conversation is especially personal for me because later this summer, I'll be walking the Hadrian's Wall Path myself, sponsored by Max Adventure. So not only will we explore Quentin's experience on the trail, but I'll also be picking his brain for advice on my upcoming adventure. Welcome back to the podcast, Quentin.
Yeah, great to be back here, Jonathan.
So set the scene for me. So I did read your article that you actually wrote for The Guardian about your walk. I'll link it in the show notes. This is actually the last national trail you did.
That's right. So, yes. I don't know why it took me so long, because it's probably the best, or one of the best, in my opinion. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I would argue it's also one of the most accessible because it's only 84 miles. I think it's one of the shortest. So yes, if anybody wants to do a national trail, like, this is the one to do, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
So when we last spoke, you were just beginning the book tour for Perimeter. How did everything go?
Thanks. So it's been, I've been doing a lot of book tours, book events, about 14. I'm still going. I've got another next week in Hatchards and Piccadilly in London. So it's still trickling along. But yeah, it's been great to see the interest and to share the story with people.
Yeah, I've enjoyed watching your social media posts. You have been everywhere.
I think five venues in Scotland, so, which was brilliant. So, you know, places I hadn't been to since the Perimeter. So it was nice to be sleeping in a comfortable bed.
So of all the national trails you've completed, where would you rank Hadrian's Wall in terms of difficulty and in terms of overall experience?
It's such a good question. I think in terms of difficulty, it would be kind of maybe a 6 out of 10, kind of a moderate level. It's definitely not as difficult as, say, the Southwest Coast Path, which is loads of ups and downs, or the Pennine Way, which is bleak moorland and huge distances. But it's definitely easier than something like maybe the North or South Downs Way, where there's lots of villages and pubs and it's like rolling landscape, or the Cotswold Way, that's the same rolling landscape with pubs. And, you know, there's challenges, but I would sort of say they're easier. And in terms of kind of theme, what's so unique about the Hadrian's Wall is that you're completely imbued in the kind of the Roman world and the Roman history from beginning to end. So that's what makes it completely unique. I think I've said that it's more like walking an idea than walking a trail, whereas all the other national trails in Britain, it's the excitement of, say, approaching Canterbury or approaching the White Cliffs of Dover, or the different landscapes blending from one to another. But this one, it's just like a road movie. You're in the Roman world from beginning to end, and that's really exciting. And then almost as if it's been choreographed to experience it, you have a museum or a site that explains what you're seeing as you go along. So it's a really rich experience.
Yeah, that's as a museum nerd, that's one thing I'm looking forward to. And I hope that my legs will allow me to stop and go visit all the museums along the way, because I know that will add such context, because this is a landscape that has been thought about for 2,000 years, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned in our last conversation that walking opens your heart and your mind. Did you find that same contemplative quality along this walk, or was it a different kind of experience than the crush of getting around the entire coastline of Britain?
I mean, it was different because it's so much shorter, but I think walking always does that, the meditative nature of it. And it's there's a kind of simplicity to the Hadrian's Wall, because really it's a coast to coast walk. So you kind of do get sea at both ends, at Newcastle and Carlisle. And then it's this sort of upland moorland route. So I think it's more, because there's not so many ideas to consider, it makes it more focused and contemplative. But I think because there's so much history to think about, my mind wasn't drifting off in poetic errors. I was really pretty much the whole time thinking about how Britain must have been 2,000 years ago. And that was unique and interesting.
So let's set the scene. You did this walk, I think, in 2023, right?
That's right. Yeah, 23. Yeah.
So what time of year did you do the walk, and how long did you give yourself to do the walk?
So I did it in April, and because I was backpacking and wild camping like I normally do, it's quite, I'm sure we'll come on to this later, but there's not many places to resupply, and there's not many places to stay on the route either. So I was kind of encouraged to do quite long days in terms of the logistics of hiking, but in terms of enjoying the route, I wanted to spend as much time at the historical site. So I ended up doing 5.5 days of walking.
Wow, and that's fast.
It is fast, but I was doing long days. But then I did half a day in Newcastle at the end, looking at the museums. I did a full day prior to walking in Carlisle at the beginning. And then my distances, I actually did a huge day after Halstead's Fort because it was so interesting. I was there for 5 hours. I did a 33-kilometer or it's wow. 20. I did a 20-mile day up to Newcastle, which I'd say is like probably the least interesting day as well. So that was my way around it. So I averaged sort of 15 kilometers a day. And then I did a monster day at the end. So that's how I did it. But that was the weird constraints of camping.
Mm. Yeah, and that's where I don't want to brag. I'm doing this walk a little differently. Being sponsored by Max Adventure, they specialize in planning people's logistics for these walks. And so I'm doing their 10-day route guidance. And so it kind of spreads the walk out much further than you kind of compressed it in. I think the longest day is 15 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then I basically walk from B&B to B&B. So no camping for me.
Yeah, it's the best way to do it, to be honest. I have this masochistic interest in camping, and I sort of feel I do like to sort of live in the environment all throughout the day. I feel kind of connected, but it is the classic best way to do it to enjoy it.
Well, it informs your art and your photography because
it does, yeah.
You are literally inhabiting the landscape, and so it gives you the time and the space to properly frame it and capture it.
And that's right, and I don't have to work to a schedule if a B&B owner wants me there at 9 and there's an amazing sunset and I'm not finished till 11, it doesn't matter. That's a sort of unique priority to me, that I have flexibility of time like that.
So the big, most important question I have to ask about the walk is, which direction did you walk and why?
I think there's no reason not to want to walk it west to east for so many reasons, because you've got so that means walking from Carlisle to Newcastle. So you have the prevailing wind behind you, which is a big advantage. And then
you did it. You had the wind in your face.
No, west. I walked the way that I'd advise people to go.
Okay.
So from Carlisle, walking east, from the west to the east. So ending up in Newcastle. And also Newcastle, to me, is more, I like Carlisle, but Newcastle's such an extraordinarily fantastic city. And it's a kind of better place to celebrate at the end. You know, there's more amazing restaurants and sites and the Tyne and the bridge. And I found that was more celebratory end, and the museum at War's End is really interesting to end it. And maybe we'll come on to this, but if you have time, I'd advise you actually continue from the War's End right to Tynemouth. So it's just a little bit longer, but then you're literally going from coast to coast, and that's kind of really, you get a totally different landscape and you're literally looking out to the sea.
Yeah, that's actually kind of what I want to do. I'm going to do east to west. I thought long and hard about it, and one of the experiences I want is I want the experience of walking out of a city into nothingness.
Yeah. Okay. That's a strong positive of your route. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's something that I have no context for that here. I live in the Chicagoland area. If I started in downtown Chicago and started walking for 100 miles in every direction, I'd still be either in Chicago or in suburbs. The idea that I can walk out of a major city into the open countryside, it was really exciting to me. And so, but I'm going to do what you suggest actually, because I'm going to ride the metro. I'm going to arrive a day early before my walk actually starts. And then I'm going to ride the metro to Tynemouth, like you said, and go to the castle, and I'm going to put my feet in the sea and say that I went in the sea in that end. And then I'm going to do the museum in Newcastle where I get the stamp on the passport.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to walk the first 5 miles.
Perfect.
Because it's all in the city.
Yeah.
And if I, by the end of that, I should end up actually back at my hotel. And then
that
way, my jet lagged body doesn't have to walk 15 miles on the first day.
That's great. And also your route is gentler for the first 2 days because it's much flatter and easier leaving Newcastle. Well, one thing I'd suggest that the official route of the footpath follows the Tyne, because the Tyne is picturesque. But if you want to be a purist, which I did, you can try and follow the actual wall through Wall's End. And that's kind of weird because it's really built up, but then you get like a tiny section of the wall outside a hair salon. And it's kind of really weird and strange, but you can actually follow the wall, but it's more urban. So it's up to you, but it is no longer.
Yeah, and so that's the plan for Newcastle. I've never been to Newcastle, so I wanted to give myself a day there to kind of orient myself and explore and see, because I've never been there other than driving through it about 10 years ago. So
it's really exciting. It almost has a sort of scale of Chicago, kind of really big, kind of high, and it's unique, and obviously there's beautiful bridges, and it's a really exciting metropolis feel. It's very unique in Britain.
Yeah. So you said earlier in this interview and in your previous interview that the Hadrian's Wall is probably the most intense national trail in terms of walking in history. And you've already touched a little bit on this, but can you elaborate a little more on what you meant by that and what makes it feel so connected to this 2000 years of Roman history?
So the famous iconic images of the wall winding across an open modern landscape. That's maybe the 2 days in the center, but the days on either side, you still have quite strong traces of it. Sometimes they're just ditches or bumps in the fields, but every day you can see it, and it's exciting because the bumps and the vallums, because it wasn't one wall, it was a big defensive ditch on the Scottish side. Then there was a wall. Then there was the Roman road. Then there was another ditch called a vallum. So there's sometimes you see multiple landforms moving through the landscape, and you can really kind of see them pretty much every day. And so it's not like you're kind of desperately looking for something, and it's kind of easy to imagine what it's like in the landscape. And because the wind sill, which is the geological feature where the land slips from north to south, because the wall follows this, it's sort of not hard to imagine where it lies, because it's not, the wall is following the geology as well. So and then because of the museums and the mile forts and all the different parts of Roman history, which are all quite different along the route, you just can't escape it. So it sort of just kind of gets into you. Yeah.
Well, and in your perimeter walk, obviously the landscape of Britain is very varied from the book. And if anybody doesn't believe me, look at his book. I mean, the landscape changes so drastically throughout your journey there, from seaside resorts to the remote Scottish Highlands. How would you describe the variety of landscape on the Hadrian's Wall walk?
Okay, so on the west of Bowness on Solway, it's kind of flat, sort of floodplains. Then it's agricultural flatland, and then it becomes kind of rolling farmland, and then it becomes rugged moorland highland in the central section. So you've got the wind sill feature I mentioned, which is a cliff on the northern side, and then rolling, pretty steep rolling hills that the wall follows, and then it slides down through agricultural land to Newcastle. So I'd say it's sort of upland moorland plus agricultural with a bit of floodplain on the other side.
Sounds like the perfect English landscape.
Yeah, it is. It is. No, it's very the pastoral rural scene, and the biggest unexpected thrill of the walk to me was not only the excitement of following this bit of history, but the views from it when the weather's clear, because you can see the whole, you can see the Lake District mountains, you can see the North Pennines, you can look north to the hills in southern Scotland and Kielder Forest. So you kind of, it's like a pivot point. You get a sense of there's Scotland, there's Alba, there's the North Pennines as you look around. And that's kind of really exciting, kind of to connect separate worlds. Because it's high enough ground, you can see that as you walk around.
That's good to know. I have to make sure I bring my long lens.
You do, yeah. Yeah.
So what kind of weather did you experience throughout your walk? Did you have pleasant weather the whole time, or did it rain? Or
it rained quite a bit. I mean, I was April. I think you're doing it in the summer, aren't you? You shouldn't
August,
have so
yeah.
much. August, yeah. So, and you'll have longer days and better light. So, you know, it was kind of cold and damp, but then, as always, there was enough gorgeous moments of sun in between it. So it was pretty windy, and it wasn't ideal, but it made for some moody pictures. And for me, I kind of like going sort of off season, because there's less tourists, especially for this route, because I think we'll probably come into it, but you might need to think quite carefully about booking tours and booking visits to the big sites, because Housesteads kind of gets rammed in the summer. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that I'm grateful for my sponsor, is they're kind of just, they're going to handle that for me.
Nice. And perfect. So, you have a valet. You have a
essentially, yeah. Well, and when they booked everything, last like September, October. So they're like, if we're going to do this, we have to book the hotel rooms now, because they will fill up by 2026.
Yeah.
And so they were really Johnny on the spot about getting everything booked in.
Fantastic. Yeah.
They don't want me having to wild camp. So the famous metal section around Steel Rig and Housesteads is what everyone pictures when they think of Hadrian's Wall. But what surprised you about the less photographed other sections of the wall at either end?
Well, I was really surprised that there are fragments of the wall in Newcastle still, and I believe at the actual wall's end. For those who don't know, the place is called War's End because of the Hadrian's Wall ending. Took me a long time to realize that's actually why the place is called War's End. And then where the wall ends as well, the shipbuilding, the famous sort of Victorian shipbuilding was. And then the Romans built a temple and a pontoon out from the end of the wall. So that whole, and how you can still come across bits of the wall in Newcastle was really exciting. And then on the I think my sort of strongest strange memory was towards the end, a place called Limestone Corner. I'd done a very long day and I couldn't find anywhere good to sleep, so I slept in the ditch itself just to get out of the wind. And then the vallum next to it has because the fascinating thing is that the wall was dug by the Roman soldiers themselves, the legionaries, over 6 years. So it's incredibly fast. And they weren't using slaves to do it. It was the Roman soldiers themselves. So you really get a sense of these poor guys in this windswept environment doing this work. But there are these huge blocks of stone, which have got the Roman drill holes in it, where they've tried to wedge them apart in order to make the ditch. And they've clearly kind of given up. So we're talking kind of 4 meter huge blocks of stone with these holes in. And I remember standing there, seeing these cracks, seeing the holes. And it's kind of funny, because you just think they've just gone, this is too much. We can't do this anymore. And you're completely taken back to, you know, the people that would have stayed there. So that was the moment I felt most connected to history on the journey.
Well, and that's interesting you mentioned that, because I believe the Roman, the legionnaires, they were made up of people from all over the Roman Empire. And it was a very multi-ethnic, multi-cultural type of organization. And so you had all these people from far-flung, warm parts of the Roman Empire and cold, rainy Northern England trying to build a wall. I imagine that must have been quite a shift from their perspectives.
That's right, because I'm sure you'll go to Vindolanda, because there are these fantastic wooden tablets that were discovered, which were sort of the Roman postcards they'd sent home. And as you say, it's people from all around the empire. And if they did their military duty, they would become Roman citizens. So there was a big incentive for them to do that. And there were people from Syria and what's now Poland, all over the world. They were position there. And then the notes which they're writing home were things like, please send me new socks. And it's very domestic stuff. And saying like to their wife how kind of boring it is and there's nothing to do. It's very wet and they're looking forward to seeing them. And yeah, it's, yeah, you can.
Well, and it's that mundanity that really connects us to them.
Yes.
And it's like, it's almost like a time machine that, you know, that they were all experiencing the same thing we would be experiencing.
Yeah.
We're cold, we're wet. Mom, please send me some socks and treats.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So what would you say is your most memorable moment from the entire National Trail of Hadrian's Wall?
I mean, it's the iconic moment approaching Halsted's Fort, where you see the windsill and the sort of bead of the wall that's in its most pristine form, just looping across the landscape. And when I saw it, it was towards the end of the day, and there was a beautiful sidelight, golden sidelight to it. And it's, you know, you imagine seeing a famous monument, and you imagine, is it going to be as amazing as the postcards? And when it is, that was truly tremendous. And probably number two, because I visited before, the sycamore gap tree had been cut, and because the Pennine Way, which is a long distance footpath through the north of England, I'd walked that as part of my Land's End General Groats walk when I was 20, so I recognised the tree kind of 30 years later. And this landscape, and that for me was a really significant moment of sort of a crossroads, literally, in my life, of being a sort of young man at the start of a career to being a kind of father many years later, but crossing the same route. It's a weird thing about these footpaths, because, you know, sometimes you think, well, you'll never be here again, but sometimes you might cross it many years later. So those would be the two memorable moments for me.
Yeah, and I guess it's a good time to talk about the famous tree. So when you did, the tree was still there or it was gone?
It was still there. Yeah.
It was still there. Okay. Well, you're very lucky then that you got to see it, because I'm bummed that's one of the things that I'm gonna miss, because I wanted to do this walk for 15 years, and so I was always like, I'm gonna see that tree for the famous scene from Robin Hood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then, oh, well, now it's gone. Yeah. And it's like, oh, well, it's a good reminder that even in the English landscape, things can be very impermanent, and that they're never going to be there forever. And it's like, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, because I remember as a young man seeing it as quite a small tree, and then seeing it again as a big tree. It's like a measure of one's own life, and then to see it so senselessly cut down. Yeah, it's still because you've still got a castle. Nick is one of the fortresses near it, is really spectacular, and the geology is seriously dramatic. So it will have a lot of power even without the tree, but the tree was the kind of, you know,
and even its trunk is a monument.
It is in itself.
And I think it's very moving that they've taken saplings from the tree and they send them around Britain so that the tree can kind of live on.
Oh, really? Hopefully. I didn't know that. That's great. I thought they were. Yeah. Okay. So
the National Trust. I think they grew 10 saplings.
Yeah.
And they were able to salvage it from the hulk of the tree.
Yeah.
And so they're gonna. And I don't know if they've decided where they're going to put them, but they're going to plant them at 10 strategic locations across the country so that the tree can kind of live on. So
nice.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your trade, the photography on the route. As a photographer, what were the most challenging and rewarding aspects of shooting along the wall, other than carrying the big equipment with you?
I mean, it's always the kind of English thing, especially in the spring, is just dealing with the weather and accepting that some hours of the day it's going to be pretty much impossible, but kind of being relaxed enough that's just what's going to happen. But then there will always be some good moments on either side, and just be ready for those good moments. The specific challenges of the Hadrian's Wall path versus other landscapes are, some of the good views are a long way away, like I mentioned with Cumbria and the Pennines, so a long lens does help, and a long lens also helps with picking out, you know, that beautiful view of the winding wall that we all want in the distance. Sometimes they actually looked more dramatic from a long way away, so that was a challenge. And then I was thinking about getting to the best moments towards the beginning and the end of the day, because the long shadows means that any landscape feature looks more three-dimensional. So the wall looks more 3D when you've got a good shadow on it. In the middle of the day when the sun's coming down the top, it doesn't look so 3D. So that makes a weaker photo. So those were the considerations for this journey.
I'm taking notes. I think I'm going to have to pack my long lens. So
You must. Yeah.
What I think I'm going to do, I think I'm going to carry two cameras, which is insane because it's like I have a small backpack. So, but
yeah,
I think I'll carry one camera with a long lens and just one with a wide angle landscape lens. Were there any iconic spots other than, say, Sycamore Gap before it was cut down that you particularly wanted to capture? And how do you approach photographing things that are so well known so that they look different or they feel different?
This was a very difficult walk to add my own signature to. I don't think I have your praising me here, but I think, you know, in 6 days, it just wasn't enough time. I think, you know, if I was to do a book about Hadrian's Wall, I'd want to dedicate months to it in all different seasons. So it was just a transient journey. And for my project on the National Trails, I'm happy about that. But it would be the fortresses like Birds of Ward or Housetead's Fort were the most kind of surprising things visually, how intact some parts were, like the sort of a latrine, which is still 2,000 years old. It still functions. It still drains itself. There's still kind of, there's carvings, there's lead fittings where the stones were attached, and you can look at them directly and know that they were assembled 2,000 years ago.
So you mentioned that, I think you kind of already answered this, but it never hurts to repeat ourselves. What time of day produced the best light? You mentioned it was towards the end of the day with the long shadows. What about dawn?
Dawn and dusk was more rich in my style of photography for coastal photography. In the moorlands, it was often just quite dark, gloomy in April at dawn and dusk. So definitely the best time for me would be an hour after sunrise and an hour before sunset, because that's when you had these, you know, because the landscape is dramatic, but it's not like massive peaks. So those rolling and the crags, they looked much more epic when there was a side light on it. So probably for you in the summer, you'd probably get good material maybe 2 hours before and 2 hours after sunset, whereas for me in April it was 1 hour. So you've got probably quite a lot of time to work with.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to think of the logistics that I should be on the trail still at least at one point of the day at those times, whether I'm starting or whether I'm finishing. At least on the long days I should be. So that's good to know. So for the perimeter, you talked about how walking lets you make your own luck as a photographer by being in position when the light is right. Did that same principle apply on Hadrian's Wall, or did you feel a compulsion to just keep moving?
No, I moved a lot slower on Hadrian's Wall than I did on the perimeter, because there was so much, you know, because of the museums are so fascinating, and because the really special bit, the 2 day central section of the wall, you know, I wasn't going to rush that. I was really lingering and taking my time over that bit. But yes, my approach is always to not force it and to allow the light to dictate where I'm going to linger and where it's going to be most interesting. That said, I did make sure that, like at the Sill YHA place, I did make sure I arrived there towards the end of the day, because that's one of the most dramatic parts. And that's for a backpacker or someone traveling independently, that's really the only place. That was the one place I stayed overnight to refuel away from the tent.
Yeah. So that you did stay in a B&B one night.
One night.
Okay. Would you wild camp it again if you were going to do the walk again?
It was exceptionally difficult to wild camp this particular long distance trail, because it's pretty barren uplands. So it was definitely stealth camping. It was definitely like a farmer, tiny copse of wood. And you're thinking, am I going to be seen walking to that wood? So it was a bit stealthy, sneaky beaky, but I kind of quite, because of the the history of the Romans and the raiding Scots. And then after the Roman era, it was the era of the Reavers, and it was a contested land of the Scots and the English, and it was continually being fought over. It kind of added to that sense of kind of mischief for my experience of the trail. But it was a difficult trail to wild camp, and I wouldn't suggest it as a first backpacking trail for anyone. I mean, if they're camping.
Yeah, I'm a lightweight. I can't camp. I mean, I was a Boy Scout, but I did my camping days when I was a kid. But now I'm too much of a softie.
Well, it's just what you enjoy. I mean, you can carry more cameras. You can carry more books. It's there's lots of upsides to traveling, in it with a B&B.
Yeah. So, what was the hardest day on the trail, and what made it difficult? Was it that 20 mile push you said?
Yeah, the hardest for me personally was the 20 mile push, just because I had that's a really long day with a heavy bag. But the hardest day, kind of objectively for most people, would have been the central section, because it's not to be underestimated. They're steep escarpments, and you go up one and down the other, whatever it is, what, 100 meters, 50 meters up and down. It's not like technically difficult ground. It's not like slip risk, but it's tiring. So that would be, I think, for most people, that's, and also I think your Max Adventures has told you that there's that 15 mile section. I think there's no way around that, because it's really from one road to the next. You just have to do that. So that would definitely be the biggest challenge, and that's also the hardest terrain.
Yeah, that kind of leads into my next question. That I wanted to make sure I asked you, and I'm sorry, I forgot to put this on the list, but I remember that I wanted to make sure I talked to you about this. Now, so when I get to the end of the walk, so it's taken me 10 days. The last day has been a 15 mile push to finish. And then I go to bed that night in the B&B that they've arranged, and I wake up the next day, and what do I do the next day after having pushed my body for the last 10 days? Do I get up and have a leisurely day and do nothing, or do I keep moving? I mean, what should I do that day after?
Well, physically, you should definitely keep moving. I mean, the best thing, whether you've run a marathon or walked a big backpacking trail, would be gentle stretching, good nutrition, and like a modest amount of gentle movement, sort of 5,000 to 7,000 steps kind of thing. If you stay still, your muscles will tense up more and you'll ultimately feel worse. But in terms of this particular trail, I would kind of combine that with going to a museum, if you're into that. So you're ending in Carlisle, right?
Well, I
end in Bowness.
Bowness. Yeah. So.
But I'd suggest perhaps you could, because there's two really interesting things in Carlisle. There's the Norman castle there, and then there's a really good Roman museum, and they're both really fascinating, and they both take quite a long time to see. So you could, when you walk through that, you might bypass that, and then on your rest and recovery day, you could eat a lot of good food and walk between those museums, and then by default you'd be doing gentle movement, and that would make you, so you won't seize up when you get back on the plane or whatever you're doing next. Yeah. So I did that by in Segendinum, the fort in Newcastle. That was my approach. So I stopped just on the outskirts of Newcastle. So my last day was a very low mileage day, and then half of it was spent looking at museums. And then the evening I had a slap up meal, stayed in a hotel in Newcastle, and then took the train home.
Yeah, and that sounds like a good idea for Carlisle, because I have to actually get back to Carlisle to take a train anywhere. So it makes sense to kind of maybe spend a couple hours there before moving on elsewhere. And I've never been to Carlisle, so it should be interesting. So what Roman site of all the sites you stopped and visited kind of made the biggest impression on you?
Well, it's so difficult. I mean, I think Vindolanda, to find these tablets that have been just excavated with these human stories of the Roman soldiers is really extraordinary. But I mean, it's Halstead's by quite a long margin is one of the most exceptional bits of archaeology in Britain. It's so intact. You're walking around it, you can see the bakery, you can see the the barracks, you can see these latrines I mentioned earlier, and you have such a strong sense of how the fort would have been. It's the most intact of all the Roman forts, so that would be kind of premier number one site, sort of Vindolanda probably second, and then Birds Award is also pretty amazing because of how it sits in the landscape. There's not much else around it, and for me, Birds Award was the first big site traveling from west to east. By the time you reach there, you might have sort of seen enough. But I think probably is, you know, it's the first site has a particular power because you've kind of, you're excited about it. But Halstead's was, you know, you must spend time for that.
Did you get the little passport stamps along the way?
I did. Yeah, it's funny. I did. Yeah.
I'm hoping to do that. I want to get the certificate says I did it.
Yeah. No, it's fun. Yeah.
So, knowing the history of the wall and who built it and what life was like for the soldier station there that you learned about along the way, did it change how you experienced the walk?
Yes, totally. I mean, it's just because I always travel alone, and then in the tent, I tend to listen to podcasts. There's quite a few good BBC Sounds stories about Hadrian's Wall, different people talking about it. So I really immersed myself in it. It was, you know, I wasn't, it was all Hadrian's Wall stuff for me. And I, that richness of experience made added to the journey.
So what's one thing that you wish someone had told you about the walk before you walked Hadrian's Wall that you kind of learned from the walk that you're like, I wish somebody had told me that would happen?
I was thinking about this question. I mean, in a way, it's far, far more interesting historically than I thought. I kind of thought it'd be, you know, a bunch of old stones. It'd be loads of things that are all the same. After half a day, I would have had enough, but actually it was so rich and deep and they're all different. It's way more fascinating. Even if you're not a hiker, just to see it as a tourist was way more interesting. So that's the definite kind of, that's the biggest surprise. And then you do have to brace yourself that the kind of walk from Newcastle to where the war starts to be dramatic is quite a long stretch where there's not so much to see, but it's sort of one day out of the 10. So that's a small price to pay. And it's still very picturesque.
Well, and you know, I'm very interested in all the history that came after of Rome in that area. So hopefully my eyes will still be entertained from the history that's there. That was after the Romans, because that's one thing that surprised me in researching this is I thought, you know, the joke is that as men, all we think about is the Roman Empire. But actually, I don't think about the Roman Empire that much. And I was starting to research. I'm like, actually, just the Roman Empire stuff actually seems kind of boring to me. But the more I research and the more I read into it, actually, it's more way more interesting than I thought it was. And I think so. I can't wait now to get on the wall and see these real places and see the archaeological, you know, remains and learn about this stuff, because it's actually way more interesting than I thought it would be.
Yeah, I think it's because you're actually walking is hard enough going up and down this moorland, and then you think that these guys were stationed there for 7 years and they were with their own pickaxes and shovels, they were digging these things and to do it so precisely, and then the organization to make it all look the same all the way through. You just a feat of labor is kind of fascinating. Yeah,
just a monument of human effort.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing for people, because I'd done quite a bit of research myself, so I wasn't surprised, but if you think you can kind of wing it and buy food and provisions along the way, you won't. I mean, it's really difficult for resupply. I mean, there are cafes around the tourist sites, but that needs planning.
Yeah, that's something to make my wife feel better about the walk. I tried to tell her that I'll never be particularly far from civilization, but that's good to know that I should pay attention to resupply.
It's not like a danger, but it's just you. It's, you know, sort of
think
5 or 6 miles to get somewhere. It would spoil the day if you had to go to, you know, along to the next town to find food.
Yeah. And I have to plug them again. Kudos to Max Adventure, because they have an app. The app gives you your route for every day, and it tells you where all the provisions and where all the places to eat are, so that you plan your route, so that you are well fed, which is nice.
That's great. I guess you get a packed lunch due from the B&B as well, and all those luxuries.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice.
So
nice.
Yeah. So yeah, it's So looking ahead, so when we last talked, you were working on climbing and camping all of the 442 mountains in England and Wales. How is that project going?
I'm doing really well. I've done 375 of them. Wow. So I've got 60 something to go. So in the summer I finished all the Welsh mountains. It's about 190, and I'm currently focused on the Yorkshire Dales. Last week I was up in the Yorkshire Dales. It's very wintry here. It was -7. It's the first time in a long time I've had to sleep with the water bottles in my sleeping bag. You know, it's like a cold water bottle to stop them freezing in the morning.
To keep the water warm.
Yeah, it would just otherwise I couldn't have my beloved coffee in the morning. And it's a really beautiful place. A mountain range called the Howgills, which are between Cumbria and the Yorkshire Dales. Mm. A bit lesser known and very, it's been said they look like sleeping elephants. They're kind of quite rounded and smooth. There's no fences or walls on it. So that's me at the moment.
Yeah, I've been in that area. That's a really pretty area. I stayed in the Northern Lake District a few years ago. What's the Troutbeck is where I stayed.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Beautiful area.
Yeah, it is.
Very remote.
Yeah,
and we're really the only background noise is sheep.
Yeah,
and have you ever done the Hard Knot Pass, the steepest road in Britain?
Yes, I did.
To visit the Hard Knot Roman Fort, which is weird because that fort is not on the wall or near the wall, but yet here's another fort they built in the middle of nowhere on the edge of civilization that has beautiful views of the Irish Sea. So it's
they're everywhere. Yeah.
They got everywhere. And that's one thing I've learned from the history too, is that while they built Hadrian's Wall, it wasn't like an impassable barrier. Like there was Roman influence beyond the wall. There were settlements beyond the wall. The wall was just kind of a demarcation point, like a center of power and control.
That's right. It wasn't strictly military. It was a kind of almost like a trade.
Yeah,
it was a symbolic mark of the northern extent of the empire, and then you'd have to pay taxes to move. And then there's the Antonine Wall, which was built subsequently further north. So the history is super interesting about their encounters with the Scots.
Yeah. So what's next for your adventures other than the mountains?
No, I'm still it's all mountains at the moment.
All mountains.
So it's the Yorkshire Dales, and then subsequently I'll be going back to the Lake District, and then after that it'll be the Cheviot Hills. So it's all North England at the moment.
When do you think you'll finish all of them?
Hopefully this time next year. Maybe if I have a good run, I might finish in the summer.
Hopefully there will be a book at the end.
There will.
What a fantastic conversation this has been, Quentin. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Angletopia podcast to talk about Hadrian's Wall. I'm really grateful. We will put links to Quentin's website in the show notes, his social media, and of course, we will link to the Perimeter book in the show notes. And I will also link to his article he wrote for The Guardian about his walk on Hadrian's Wall. If you're planning to walk Hadrian's Wall yourself, his photography and his insights are invaluable preparation. And if anything, you can look at some beautiful pictures, which he's very humble, but I think it's some of his best work. So if you want to follow along with my own Hadrian's Wall adventure this summer, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast and following Angletopia on social media. If you're considering your own walk on Hadrian's Wall or other national trails, consider booking with our partner for my upcoming trip, Max Adventure. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, like, or leave a comment. And if you love the Angletopia podcast, please consider joining the Friends of Angletopia Club, where you can get early access to new episodes and connect with other enthusiasts about Britain. So join us next time as we continue exploring the people, places, and stories that make Britain's history and culture so endlessly fascinating to discover. Thank you again, Quentin.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Great to talk to you again. Okay?